With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes. Unsung heroes.
Hi, my name is Ricky Wilde and you're listening to Unsung Heroes. Thank you for joining us. This week, Lee and I were lucky enough to catch up with the amazing Grace Lightman. Grace has recently released an album called Silver Eater. It's probably up there as one of my favourite albums ever, and both Lee and I were totally blown away. Singles like Repair, Repair, Aztec Level, Faultless, An Ordinary Life. The songs are so beautifully crafted and it's so refreshing to hear something sounding so new and different. And she has a style all of her own that it's quite hard to do that, I think. And for her to be able to have done that on her debut album is quite astonishing. Anyway, so yeah, let's get straight into it. Miss Grace Lightman.
So, welcome to Unsung Heroes. Ricky Wilde and myself, Lee Bennett, are here today with the wonderful Grace Lightman. We are backstage at the Islington in London, just hours before Grace is about to take to the stage for her headline gig, which we are both very excited to be at. So, Grace, welcome.
Hello there.
We are super excited to talk to you. We've got loads we want to ask you about. Obviously, our podcast is about songwriting and process, but we really want to know about your musical history and, of course, your fabulous album, Silver Eater, which we are massive fans of here. So we really want to talk to you about that. So if we can take things back to the beginning and kind of trace the steps of where does your love for music stem from? Were you a musical child?
Yeah. So I've got a photo of me when I was probably about, four, and I'm sat on my dad's baby grand piano, and I've got a little cap on and I've got sunglasses that are heart-shaped, and it's like probably one of my favourite childhood photos of me because it's like, oh, nothing's changed, except that I probably can't play piano any better than I could when I was four. So nothing, literally nothing has changed. But yeah, my dad is a musician.
Oh, okay.
And a music producer as well. So I've grown up like with the studio in my house the whole time.
So did you get to tinker and experiment?
Yeah.
Wow.
And like mainly just kind of an appreciation for music and it just always being around.
What's your dad? As a musician, what did he play?
He is a guitarist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he's like, basically he's from Canada and he came to England when he was quite young to basically be a session guitarist.
Oh, wow.
So he's always been massively kind of supportive of my pursuits as a young person into the music industry. And then my mum works in comedy as well, so she's super supportive of like the creative industry freelance aspects of everything. So there was no problems there. And yeah, I was just really lucky to have a lot of the creative kind of culture around me.
Did you always feel that you were going to be a singer or a writer, or did you have a vision?
I found my diary from when I was 10 and on like maybe the fifth page, it says something like, okay, listen, I've decided I'm going to start a new career in songwriting.
Wow.
And I've written 3 songs already. Here's one of them. So I wrote down all the lyrics of the song.
And can you remember any of the lyrics?
I'm not going to repeat them because rubbish. It's quite embarrassing. It's something about watching films on TV.
That's a very young age to know what you're going to do.
Well, I don't think I actually did very much of it, because I went to school and I did write some songs at school as well, at secondary school, but I actually ended up not doing music GCSE because I was already doing like some other creative GCSEs and I wasn't allowed to pursue too many at the school I was at. So I think I decided to keep music as a thing that I could enjoy and it not be work, which is ironic because now it's work, which is fine with me.
But it's lovely to do something that you're passionate about, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're very lucky in that aspect.
Very lucky,
as I am.
What music did Mum and Dad listen to? What did they expose you to?
Every night I used to listen to The Carpenters Gold or ABBA Gold. So 2 compilation albums.
Fantastic, both albums.
Just
awesome.
To get to sleep, but obviously I'd just stay up and listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And my brother listened to a lot of kind of like Nirvana and grunge music. So I was kind of listening to that as well.
Yeah.
And then I also was watching loads of music TV channels. So I would watch anything that was around then and buy the CDs of anything that was around then.
So you soaked it all up, basically. Yeah. Lots of influences going in.
Like things like pop music, basically, like Britney and Destiny's Child and Shania Twain and stuff
like
that.
Of course, yes.
And are they influences in your writing at the moment, or are there other influences, you think?
I think what I've always found is that I try not to make my writing in the style of anyone's, but what ends up happening is you accidentally just do get influenced by people. So the Carpenters thing, like I wanted to just write really, well, the term classic, I wanted to write really classic songs that kind of were timeless.
Yeah.
And that I realized after writing them that was something that obviously the Carpenters would be quite into doing. Like the music's all kind of like, the production was the thing that aged it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the songwriting was much more classic.
Yeah.
The production on Silver Eater, it's astonishingly perfect. It's my album of the year. I've said it many a time and tweeted it many a time.
Oh,
but
when you get to hear the other podcasts, you'll hear it referenced several times.
Yeah. We're always talking about it and listening to it. So it's
amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, it's a beautiful album and something you should be really proud of. When you're writing, do you demo it yourself or...?
There's a lot of different stuff going on with the writing. It's never kind of the same thing. But I write with a writing partner, Patrick James Pearson, a.k.a.
He that hears in colours.
He hears in colours, yeah. He does a lot of that. he's got synesthesia, but that's kind of never really... that's not a huge part of our process together, because I don't think he doesn't make that part of his process outwardly, because it's just something that he's always had. But
could you explain what that is?
So it's when, to my knowledge, I'm going to get it wrong now. To my knowledge, it's when, the way that he has it is that he hears sounds in colour. So he'll get like an overwhelming sense of a colour come to him when he plays or hears certain chords and things. So I think sometimes it's for him about like the way the colours go together, but like I don't want to misquote him.
Does he tell you that at the time in terms of I'm seeing or hearing red or blue? Or...
I can think of maybe 3 times that he said it to me in my life.
Because the colour blue is really relevant here, isn't it? In terms of there's we were talking before we came on air about Papa Smurf and the guy that, so there's a guy in America that had a skin condition
and
he self-medicated with something and it turned him blue and that sparked a song. So
that's
he's your guy.
That was something I heard about. I was basically thinking of dyeing my hair silver and someone just told me about this guy and I googled him and I was just like, what a strange human. And I just kind of got a bit obsessed with the idea that someone would think that it was okay to do that. And like, at what point would you be like, oh my God, my skin's gone blue and my hair's gone silver. Like, why am I still doing this? Like, why
did that
inspire
a particular song or the
so
theme?
Yeah, so that was I heard about this guy, went to visit Pat in Devon, where he lives, and I was living in London, and we'd like meet up to write, and I was talking to him about this guy. I was like, I've heard about this guy and I really want to write a song about him. So we kind of didn't really write a song about him, but we started writing Repair Repair, and we just sort of were coming up very quickly with the words for the verses and sort of dropping them in as we were going along. It was quite a nice quick process for that. And one of the words is silver eater, so becoming I'm alien to an earth in a wormhole. And that was kind of like a little nod to Paul Carrison with his silver eating.
Wow.
And like the fact that he became something else, became a different version of himself, which looked really alien. And then after writing Repair Repair, we wrote Silver Eater, the song. And that was like the moment where the whole concept for the album kind of became one.
Yes. Which we'll come back to. We're just going to take you backwards a step, because this is sort of your second life for music in some ways, in terms of you were in a band before called The Hypnotic Eye.
I was, yeah.
And it's a very different sound to what we know you for now. Mm-hmm. Were you a big part of that sound?
Not at all. I was just the lead singer of that band. I didn't write any of the songs. I actually felt at the time that I couldn't write songs then. I think I'd given up songwriting because of GCSEs. Not so much a confidence thing. Well, I guess it probably was a confidence thing, but I think I was quite in awe of the guy who did write the songs at the time, because it was like a whole new world to me, that sort of 60s garage psych rock world. And I always romanticized that era, but I never quite got into it. And I thought that band was my way into it. And there's only so much of that kind of music I can take, because as much as it's great, it's like all very similar.
Yeah.
And I think I felt like Lindsay, who ran the band and wrote all the music, was just totally lived that world, and he knew everything about it, and he was writing the songs and so perfectly within that world that I just didn't feel like there was any reason for me to get into it.
Yeah.
So I kind of just like kept on my journey of singing and
we watched a video of you in the band. It's one of the videos that you made, and I was saying to Rick, I was watching it back, and it was like, can almost see that you don't quite believe it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. Like, you were there, but now when we see you perform and in videos, it's like, ah, that's Grace.
Yeah, I don't feel like it really ever was me, that band. It was definitely my introduction into feeling like this is what I want to do. Definitely. That was
sometimes
that
you
was
have to
moment.
Go through stuff like that to find yourself and find your place in the music industry, wherever you want to be as a writer or as a performer.
Definitely.
So,
I think also the fact that it wasn't all about me, it was about the whole band, and I'm a narcissist and wanted it to be all about me.
Well, also, it's opened your mind up musically, because the diversity of Silver Eater is
wild.
Unbelievable. Every track is just so different.
Yeah, and the other thing being that in that band, that's where I met Ben Baptie, who produced Silver Eater, because he used to work with Lindsay, who ran the Hypnotic Eye, and started to produce us, and I met him in session whilst I was recording all of the vocals across 2 days for a whole album, and Ben and I realized that we'd come across something together. We were like, this is definitely something that we've got to do again. And that was when I was like 19, so Ben and I sort of, we've been really close friends ever since then, but it wasn't until he came to my gig a few years ago and said to me that he wanted to get into production properly, and he wanted to work with me on my album and use it as his sort of his learning curve. But
what a learning curve in terms of, he set the bar really high.
Yeah, so it was amazing working with him and meeting him through the band, so I have a lot to thank for.
As a writer, are you one of these writers that are constantly thinking up ideas in your head and put them on your iPhone and then going back and developing them in the studio, or is it just have a writing process on a particular day, you think, right, I'm going to do some writing on that day?
It's kind of, it's both. But I do like to schedule in writing sessions because I'm quite undisciplined, and I think that's why I really like collaborating with people, because I come up with all these ideas and I can't settle on one. So I just spend about 4 hours thinking of one line because I've thought about 30 different possibilities for it. So I like to and that's the same with just deciding to sit down to write.
Yeah.
I like to schedule it in, go and write somewhere else as well. Maybe not like in my bedroom either. I don't really like doing that. But I do the thing of like writing down lots of different things and voice memos on my phone. It's a lot of me walking around the streets voice memos that just don't actually sound like anything. But they're like they're really weird.
I get that when I go into shops and I'm hearing music in the background, and it'll be like the song that's out at the moment, and then I'll just start singing over the bass line. And that's where the song originates. Yeah. And then I'll obviously change all the bass line when I come to actually write it in the studio. But that's a real good writing point for me, is walking in shops.
Mine's like bus stops.
That's a good one.
My one, because I think
More bus stops.
Yeah,
Rick.
I need to hang around those
I think
places.
It's good to like be bored, because when you're bored, you create stuff in your head. Yeah.
At night as well, just as you're going to sleep, I get a lot of ideas then.
Yeah, that's the hardest one for me though, because I get that too, because I have that real in limbo state of wake and sleep, but my body's dead by that point, so I find it really hard to like get up or even grab my phone to like put it down.
Yeah.
Or sometimes when I do, I listen back the next day and I'm like, that was terrible. That was a good idea.
What was I thinking? So you're on tour at the moment. How many gigs are you doing on this tour?
I think it's somewhere between 9 and 11, but I always forget because I'm really bad with numbers.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same, don't worry. And do you like gigging?
I love gigging. Performing, I absolutely love. Whenever people ask me what my favourite thing is out of writing, recording and gigging, I literally couldn't say it's all equally amazing to me.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited to tour, because I haven't actually done a tour longer than 5 days ever. So I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Are you going to take this into next year as far as the album's concerned?
Hopefully. Like, this tour ends in December as it stands, but I'm hoping to be touring more in January.
Are you thinking about, you know, if you're someone that's creating all the time, was there already a plan in terms of the second album already, or how that will go? Is there a concept for the second album?
Yeah.
Oh, she's got it. It's there already.
There's a concept. I've got lots of ideas already for the next few things. I actually wrote Silver Eater quite a long time ago. It's taken me a really long time to get it recorded, because I've never really been able to afford to do it properly. So it's been in Ben's downtime. We've both been doing it as a sort of labour of love. So
one of the songs that's on Kim's album that's released last year was 10 years old, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that happens a lot.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
But in that time, I sort of have been thinking about next stages. I've had a lot of time to think about it, basically.
And a couple of the tracks have had new lives already as well, and got re-recorded for the album. Was that a case of just wanting to freshen them up, or...?
Yeah, I think I always had Repair was always part of the Silver Eater concept, as was Fangs, actually, which didn't make it onto the album, because I just kind of felt like it had had its time already. But I felt like, having put Repair out, I never was quite happy with it. Like, that feeling of unsettledness.
Yeah.
Like,
unfinished.
There was just something about it, and I can't put my finger on it. And I knew that Ben was the person who was going to be able to produce it the way that it needed to be, and he knew it as well.
The chorus is so much bigger on the remix.
Yeah.
When it hits, it's so much better
and,
for
and
it.
And actually, the whole structure is, like, really different, kind of in quite a subtle way that a lot of people wouldn't realise. But
I was actually scared to listen to the new version of Faultless.
Yeah, someone actually told me that they preferred the old version when I was just hadn't even put it out yet.
Well,
the new one.
It was because I love that song so much. And when someone had said, oh, it's redone on the album, I was like, oh, no, it's too perfect as it is. But I love it. But I was literally thinking, I don't know if I want to listen to this, because I don't know how you can improve on it, because it's such a perfect song.
Well, Faultless was one I was always happy with, so I didn't want to change it too much.
No.
And actually, we used quite a lot of the original tracking for it, but we redid all the drums and added quite a lot of different synth parts, and then took them all out and added more and did all the stuff, and I did a new vocal for it as well, and I'm like really pleased that I did the new vocal, because it's one of my favorite vocals on the album. So that one worked out. It was risky, but we got to the end of the tightrope.
Normally when I hear a track, and if I'm not hearing it within two or three listens, I kind of lose interest.
Yeah.
But with your stuff, there's always something new that I'm hearing, and I just find it so interesting. It suddenly hits me, and then I realise where you're coming from and how brilliant it is. And I don't think I've heard an album that's hit me that way, that's taken so long for me to actually understand.
That's good.
I think a lot, yeah, it is. And Aztec Level.
Yeah.
The time signatures in that, it took me ages for me to get my head around that.
Yeah.
And how did you write that?
That was the day that Pat and I lost our tiny minds. I don't really know. Like, it started off very different to how it ended up being, not even just production-wise. Like, it started off very differently writing-wise.
Yeah.
And then there was I remember a conversation about dropping some bars out. But it was quite a long day of us trying something and then actually just taking a break from it, realizing it wasn't working, and then just kind of throwing all of the rules.
It's really
out
brave.
Of the
I've got to say, that's really brave to do that.
Yeah, it was a weird one.
I'm not that brave. A lot of my stuff is just normal, sort of, you know, the normal bar countage. But when it came to your stuff, I thought that is really cool.
And I think the thing is, to aim to be to do the unexpected thing.
Yeah.
Like, if you feel like it, there's a natural chord progression that everyone's waiting for, try and do the opposite to that, or try and do something that still works musically but isn't the thing that everyone's expecting.
One of the lyrics I have to ask you about, because it's the one that really sticks in my head, is I think tennis is super cool.
Yeah.
It seems so one-dimensional. Where does that come from?
Just kind of came out.
It's incredible.
It was like,
it's so hooky.
We kind of, with that song, Pat and I, when we'd lost our minds and took a break, we wrote down, I mean, this is us taking a break, but we got loads of little pieces of paper and wrote out the alphabet on each one of them, and then we each, like, we divided them in half and then tried to do like words with one or two syllables that were within like the Silver Eater world.
Wow.
And I think tennis must have been on one of them.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then that's why the end of the song where it goes lemonade, bring it to the hotel.
Yeah.
That was because we'd written the whole song and then we're like doing this outro, bobbing our heads along, and then I just like basically picked up a few of the pieces of paper that were on the floor and just kind of like laid them out and picked up the microphone, hit record, and just said the words. And Pat was like, yeah, okay, that'll do. She's like, yeah, right.
It's so obscure yet seems so perfect in the song.
Yeah, it's a good fun.
Great.
Well, I've never written that way, and I think it's really interesting.
Give it a go.
I think I will.
Yeah.
Lots of random words on the floor, Rick.
But it's because we couldn't, essentially, it's because we couldn't come up with anything. So
I think Bowie wrote like that, didn't he?
He had like a machine that he invented where he put words together and then the machine would put them in an order for him. We obviously were inspired by that.
Yeah. Are you always together when you write, or can you write like the modern way of sending things back and forth?
We can. And we do write with other people as well, but it's just kind of like might as well do the thing that's the most enjoyable thing and the most effective thing, which is getting together, sitting in a room and playing music. Like, our whole thing is that if the song doesn't stand up alone as just a song that you can play on a guitar or piano, then it's not necessarily going to work for us.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously lots of the songs ended up being kind of like really synth based, but a lot of them just started as piano based songs.
So what's the live show? What do we expect from the Silver Eater live experience.
You can kind of hear quite a lot of it.
I just want to set the scene here. We're actually in your dressing room.
Yeah.
Just for the people that are hearing here. All that music in the background is Grace's new album.
Well, it's good, soundtrack. Isn't it? It's a good little soundtrack on this interview.
So, and whetting our appetite, and we're really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I hope you enjoy it.
There's obviously a lot of visual imagery with this, with the record, and you work with your brother, I believe, on the videos.
Yeah.
And there's a whole sci-fi theme obviously going on. I think you mentioned Twilight Zone as a big influence.
Yeah.
So does that influence your writing? Do you see some of the things that you think I'm now going to write about that film or that character? Because Under the Skin really sprung to mind. Have you seen Under the Skin?
Yeah, but I didn't see Under the Skin until like way after I'd written the album, even after I think we'd produced, recorded and mixed it.
Because that's such a perfect
companion
to it.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Except she's evil.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
How do you find working with your brother? Obviously, I work with Kim and Kim, and it's a similar thing, but how's that process?
Well, I think what's quite funny is that, and Ben and Pat are both going to hate this, but they're both like brothers to me, and then my brother is my actual brother, who's also obviously like a brother to me, because he is my brother. So I feel like I only work with people when they're brothers to me or something. But my brother, Alex, is a really, really talented film director, and we kind of ended up, like, we actually always said that we weren't gonna do videos together because he does feature films, and we sort of didn't really want to make we didn't want to mix family with work kind of thing. And then we sort of almost were forced to, because I tried working with other people and it just didn't really work out. I didn't feel like anyone really understood my vision, and because it's such a visual album for me. And this is before even Silvery It was written. This was like with Faultless, when we made the original music video for it. I basically had this idea of doing a beauty pageant, and my brother was like living with me, and then we were also living with a director of photography and a stage manager who was an art director on films, and we were like, oh, okay, like, you guys up for doing this? And everyone was, and that's one of unfortunately it's not online anymore, but that was one of my favorite music videos, and totally made by us and totally produced by us.
Yeah,
we did everything for it, and it was really fun, really, really
fun. You get on well when you work together, there is no
My brother's like my best friend,
so we
have a lot of people think we're twins because we have a very telepathic.
What's the age difference between
4 years?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are you all younger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you and Kim are like not even barely a year apart, aren't you?
No.
So you are almost twins.
But yeah, no, we've always been really close, and it's a lovely working relationship.
Yeah.
Hence, 35 years later, we're still...
And the rest.
Writing, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, so, we love it.
That's
are
so
you,
cool.
Are you tempted into kind of a lot of the one-off collaboration type stuff that sort of dominates the Spotify and iTunes chart?
Yeah, I mean, I've done them before and I'll continue to give them a go. I think I love collaborating with people, so I try not to discriminate.
Well, I think we've taken up enough of your time here, Grace. I know you've probably got soundcheck.
Yeah, I've got to go soundcheck.
Yeah, and I just want to thank you so much for letting us in, and it's been lovely talking to you and getting to know you.
Oh, awesome. But great
thank
to get
you so
to know
much.
You guys.
Great
too.
To see the gig later. We can't wait. We'll be there.
Yeah,
really look forward
along.
To it.
Thanks, guys.
Lovely to meet you. Thanks, Grace.
And you too. Bye.
Okay, thank you. Huge thanks to Grace for letting us into her world. What a lovely chat that was, and it was so nice to get to know her and to hear what makes her tick, really. I found all the stories about how she writes absolutely fascinating. I love her passion. I love her passion for her career and her songs and for music. It was wonderful to see, and both Lee and I wish her all the best of luck with not only the album, but with her career in the future. She deserves to be absolutely massive. And I'm sure she will be. Yeah, this week I wanted to talk about a couple of things, really. First of all, we have our guests that we always have. But after that, I wanted to have a little chat about something else that I'm involved in, which is the Wild Charity Ball. I just wanted to explain to people what it's all about and why we're doing it. But we'll touch upon that a little bit later on.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And the reason why I mentioned the wild boar is because the next guest that I'm going to be chatting with, I bumped into him at one of the Let's Rock gigs last summer. And it was lovely to see him again after all this time. I used to knock about with Nev back in the day. He was recording all his stuff at Rack Studios in the studio next to where I was working. And the guy who was engineering his work was a guy called Pete Schwer. And Pete was my best man at my wedding. He was engineering for Neville and producing some of the stuff that he was working on. And that artist was called Neville Keighley from Baloey Sum. What an amazing band and what beautiful songs. Imagination being probably one of the best tracks of the 80s, I think, along with another track called Some People that I really loved as well. Well, as I say, we bumped into each other and we got chatting about the old times. And he said, what are you up to now? And we were at that time organising the next Wild charity ball. I asked him if he would like to perform at that ball, and bless him, he said yes, he'd love to. It was just lovely to rekindle that friendship, and it was just so lovely to see him. So yeah, let's get straight into it. Ladies and gentlemen, Neville Keighley from Baloey Sum. Welcome, Nev Keighley, an amazing writer and a wonderful artist, and so it is an honour to have you in my studio.
Well, I'm honoured to be here.
When did we first meet? 85. 85, was it?
Yeah, well, no, it might have been 84 because,
I think it's
because of Rack,
then.
You see. Yeah.
And you were recording Imagination and Some People at Rack Studios with Pete Schwer.
Well, the first versions of Imagination, I mean, Some People was recorded at Rack originally.
Yeah.
And then with Pete. And then,
well, Pete Schwer, let's just tell you who Pete Schwer is.
Yeah.
Pete Schwer was my engineer. He recorded all my early hits with me at Rack Studios.
Was he a house engineer?
He was. Right, he was originally
with
a house engineer.
With Phil Thornett?
Phil Thornett, who later went on to record, write and record Torn for Natalie.
Nice
Brooker.
Guy. He was a lovely bass player Phil. As well, wasn't he? In the Cure.
He was in The Cure.
Yeah.
But he's now bass player for Bryan Adams. So,
I've got a funny Bryan Adams story. I live around the corner from, Bryan Adams has got a house near where I live.
Okay.
He's a lot bigger than
right.
But anyway, Bryan and for years, you know, when I wasn't in the business, you know, we wander around. I used to see him and I'm always in pubs and things. I was in those days. Now I'm a little bit more grown up. But, you know, and always a bit worried because I was with a load of mates and, you know, and a couple of times we were a bit rowdy.
A bit rowdy,
anyway, I went to an opening of something once and Bryan Adams was there and he said, hello, mate. Hello. I said, oh, hi, nice to meet you, Bryan. Thinking, oh, God. Hope he doesn't recognise me, because I do stick out like a sore. You know, I mean, white hair then. And he goes, okay, I know you from somewhere. I know. And I said, oh, no, we've never met. You've never seen me before. And I was thinking, oh, my God, please don't, how immature I'd been, you know. Pissed in the corner of a pub. Anyway,
we've all been there. Don't worry.
Sorry, they sidetracked me to Brian.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, he's an amazing guy. So.
But they were great days, and Pete Schwer finished up being my best man at my wedding to my beautiful wife Mandy, and we had some great days back then, and I remember a lot of parties and a lot of raucous.
There's so much energy. I mean, we just never stopped. Yeah. It was every, every day we did something.
But you had so much energy, Nev. I mean, that, I think you're the one that drove us onto all that, mate.
No, all of us. But you know, Pete Shreer wasn't supposed to be producing my album. It was supposed to be Pete Shreer and another guy, and the other guy disappeared.
Who's that?
I feel bad. I don't want to, I mean, it was Ian Little. And he'd done the Seven and the Ragged Tiger with Alex Sapkin, the Duran Duran. So the first day of the recording, he turned up, and he was great. And then he didn't turn up again. So me and Pete were sitting in the studio, and I wasn't going to stop, so we carried on. And Pete was a little embarrassed because he wasn't supposed to be producing. He was the engineer. And I'd go, well, what does this sound like? Make the decisions. And
well, Pete was a great ideas man. I mean, he always came up to me.
He was a great engineer.
It was fantastic.
And the album was actually ready to be released, but I wasn't happy with it, and it wasn't peaceful because most of, you know, you could see the credits. But he was never supposed to be producing. He was supposed to be the engineer. The producer disappeared. Funny enough,
did Pete do Imagination, or was it?
He did the first Imagination.
Okay, there's a few versions.
There's a few versions because the thing is, I always knew it was going to be a great song. He did the basics of Some People, and then I took Some People to New York, and Carlos and Steve Thompson, and put the polish on that. But the basics of Some People were done by...
Go through who those guys are.
Carlos Alomar had been with... Obviously was with David Bowie for many years. Carmen Rojas as well. He'd done the Let's Dance, Serious Moonlight and whatever. And, I mean, obviously then went on to do, you know... But, amazing, well, this is probably down to the story about how I got to go to New York to do Imagination. I knew I was in trouble. EMI had spent a fortune, and they were running out of patience with me, and the album didn't sound right. It was... So someone said, get a remix done. There's these new young remixes in America. Right, so I went to New York and took with me a track. They did an amazing job. And I said, my album's shit. You don't fancy re-recording it? They said, well, yeah, because they hadn't recorded anything before. But they said, there's a couple of problems. Record company are not going to let me, having recorded the whole album already again. And you're not named producers. I said, so we've got to come up with a plan. So the plan was, we'll put together the most amazing musicians and band for you. And this is New York in the 80s. It was rocking, right?
Wow.
And I was very English, so I said, that's amazing. You can do that. I'll persuade Dave Ambrose at EMI to at least do one track with you. So I went back and said, Dave, these people are great. These people are always good. Listen, you know, I'm in so much trouble about you. They keep on having a go at me in the meetings. I said, come on, Dave, let me just do one track. I'll do Imagination. Come on, I know it's going to be. I've got Carlos Alomar. I've got Robert. I had Bernard Edwards and Tony Thompson from Chic. Oh, you know, they'd never worked before. So Carlos was happy. Everyone was happy. Everyone was doing this for these young producers. And
astonishing that you, as a new artist, that you could gather these legends together to record.
I'm pushy.
But the tenacious as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I didn't stop to think what happens if it goes wrong either.
No,
but there is one funny story.
Dived
I mean, the actual song was recorded on a Saturday afternoon in the rain in New York, and it's all live. So you can hear that when the vocal moves around, everything moves around, the drums moved, Tony and Bernard. I mean, it's a classic. But I knew I had that moment. And when I came back to London on Monday morning and gave it to them, I said, there's your hit and whatever. And that was it. But what happened
and
was...
What a great sounding record, Imagination.
What a song.
I mean, it's a fantastic song. How did you write that? Where did the ideas come from?
It's a really simple song. I mean, it's a simple song. I wrote it at the kitchen table in about 3 years before.
Was it written in your head? Did you have a guitar?
It was one of those songs that just wrote itself. She lit a cigarette. You got to the bridge. She blamed excesses. It goes, it's an obvious, it's only a three chord wonder. And then, Imagination! I mean, it just came out. So it was the easiest thing I ever wrote. But, I mean, obviously, as a songwriter yourself, you know, you know, the easiest thing you ever wrote takes 10 years, you know. I mean, so, and thousands of songs by the wayside. But there is one funny story about that, because Dave said, well, you know, get a budget. So in the early days of faxes, I remember this fax came through to my publishers. The budget was $34,000 for to record Imagination and Walk Away, right? The publisher at the time said, he was a great guy. He said, Ian Reed, that was it. He said, nah, He said, not going to go for that. And this fax, chuk, chuk, chuk. They're not going to. So I said, well, Tipex out the zero at the end. So I had so much fun.
That is so you.
So we faxed through the EMI, $3,400, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't, luckily, the actual invoice didn't come through for about 6 months. Yeah. And I remember Dave coming in with this, what's this? $34,000. I said, oh, fuck it. You know, who cares? You know? Oh, sorry, God. Dave. I must have, that's very expensive. What happened? Anyway, but I remember doing that as well. You know, I mean, I had no shame in those days.
No,
now
no.
Obviously,
but amazing. Yeah. And so you had all that.
Well, then I persuaded EMI.
Yeah,
I said, listen, this is great. We've got two great tracks here. Look, the whole company is, you know, and it sounded different. The problem was, it didn't sound English. It didn't sound American.
Yeah.
So they said, what are we going to do with you? What are you? Are you a band? Are you? And I said, you know, I'm me. And it's very difficult to be called Blue Sam when you're not a band and you're not. Yeah.
And where did that name come from?
Oh, I needed a name for the first gig at the Embassy Club.
Where did,
well, I didn't. You couldn't get a record deal as a solo artist,
right?
Because
so it had to be a band name.
Had to be a band name, yeah. But my ego is such. I don't really. I've never been really good at being part of a band, you know. And so I thought, well, I don't want it to be called the JoJo's or whatever. It's got to be something that's a bit ambiguous.
Yeah.
Probably the dumbest thing I ever did, to call myself a name that no one could pronounce.
Yeah.
So Spell or you know. And so I thought, well, I'll call myself. It was Louis, the Kinsman song was out. The Blues Brothers was out at, at that time, the movie. So I said, well, I call myself the Bluey Something Band. I never got as far as the Something Band. So that was it. That's it. But anyway,
what is some? What
was going to be something? I never thought of what the something was.
And it all makes sense.
And they said to me, "We need it by tomorrow. We got to do the posters. What are you called?" And the other thing is, I did the first gig, and after 5-6 years of trying to get a record deal, and the songs were all in place. I'd done the demos. This had finally worked. I got the band together. I went on stage, Monkbury's in German Street. I don't know whether you remember it, a tiny place. And I went on, and I stood there and I just froze and I thought, this is terrible. So afterwards, everyone said, you know, that was terrible. That was absolutely terrible. You've got to do something. I had 2 weeks. So I thought, sod this. Blade Runner was out.
Yeah.
And so I went off and I spent 7 hours dyeing my hair white. And, and white was rare in those days because you couldn't get it white. I remember my head was burnt to smithereens.
Yeah,
and all this big, I mean, Billy Idol had white, but I don't know how he got it white. I mean, anyway, so I had white hair.
Yeah.
So I completely changed my look. And the other thing is, I drank a lot before I went on stage, which I kept going and doing that for many years because the nerves, you know. But then the next gig was just amazing.
Wow.
Know? Because I had my manager at the time was living opposite a school nearby, and we got a coach, and we put them on the coach. And so when the A&R people got there, there was always a big crowd outside my gigs.
Yeah, yeah.
So we shipped them in, and by that, you know,
rent a crowd.
And then once you got your rent a crowd going, it was, you know, all the things. You know, I wasn't going to fail this time.
No,
right, you know, after all those years.
So obviously, you had all that initial success, but then you took a time out.
Yeah, I mean,
I know.
You know,
the 90s came, and
the 90s
and
came,
basically shat on the 80s, and it was like, and no one wanted to know anything.
I did an album in London. I spent, and I got great musos, great English musicians, right?
Yeah.
And I remember Carl from Underworld and all these great guys, and it's a raucous album. Eventually got a deal with BMG in Germany, and they were useless, and Arista over here, and they were useless. They said, oh, thanks very much. So I thought, sod this, I'm out.
Yeah.
And that was about 93, 94, and
And then you've come back again. And how lovely is that? The last time I saw you was at the Let's Rock gig, and that's the first time I'd seen you since the bloody 80s.
I know.
And it was just like stepping back in time, and it was so lovely to see you, Nevin, and so lovely that you're back here.
So lovely to be back, you know.
And to share all those lovely memories that we have, you know.
Yeah. And it was like,
so cool.
It was like the 30 years hadn't been.
It was like it was yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
But so you're back. You're doing the Let's Rock gigs, which
is wonderful. It's great fun. Yeah,
and a great band.
Yeah.
And you're there doing it with us now, which is wonderful.
And hopefully, I'm going to carry on with my new career.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, you're going to be joining us at the Wild Ball. Yeah. Well, we'll have a great night.
We are going to have a great
night. You've not done the Wild Ball yet. I think this is our fourth one now, and it's amazing. It's a great night, and everybody has a great time. Oh, it's lovely.
Can't wait.
Oh, it's work. Anyway, I'm. I'm not going to talk about that anymore.
No, it's great to see you, so, you know, it's obviously something really close to your heart.
It is. It is. It's a passion. And through it, we've met some incredible people as well. And we love hosting it. Mandy's unbelievable the way she organises it all. I only just do the entertainment side, so I don't really do much of it. But Mandy does all the hard work, and it's a wonderful thing. But I just wanted to thank you, Ned, for joining us, and it's going to be lovely to have you there. And I can't wait to see you on stage with us.
Can't wait.
Yeah. So, that's pretty much it, I think, mate.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you for joining me. Yeah. Oh, thank you for joining us. And thanks, Nev.
Thank you.
Yeah, how amazing was that? Just seeing Nev again in my studio and having such a lovely chat and talking about the old times. I really did enjoy that. And thank you so much, Nev, for coming down. Always lovely to see you, mate. Really, I just wanted to go back to what we were talking about the wild boar, which we touched upon towards the end of that interview there. We are going a little bit off-piste here. I do appreciate that. So you don't have to listen any longer if you think it's going a little bit too far off-piste. Although it is about unsung heroes, my wife being an unsung hero. So it is about Mandy, really. But it's also about a charity event that Mandy and I host every 2 years. The wild boar all came about because one morning Mandy and I were laying in bed and we got the dreaded phone call saying that something had been flagged up in one of her scans. Mandy had recently had a mammogram, and the reason why she'd had a mammogram is because her nan had died of breast cancer years previously, and through that she made sure that she had a mammogram every year privately, and thank God she did, because it flagged up a condition called DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ. On the NHS, they don't screen anybody until they're 50 years of age, so at that time Mandy was kind of like late 40s, and had she have not had that done privately, probably she wouldn't be here with us anymore, because it would have blown up into a massive cancer. And I think that's a really good argument for the NHS to be screening women a lot earlier than that, maybe 40, 45, you know. But that's another matter. But through this whole process, Mandy's care from her doctors was second to none. It transpired that Mandy had to have a double mastectomy along with reconstruction. There were quite a few operations, in fact. One of them was like 14 hours long. It was pretty intensive. And the operation was 100% success. And she is now 100% clear, with virtually no chance of it ever returning. So that's fantastic news. Mr. Hyder Ridder, Mr. Peter Crane and Miles Dixon were the ones that saved Mandy's life. They were just fantastic people, incredible surgeons. And yeah, they really turned it around for Mandy, for all of us. And we will be forever grateful to them. It was through that we decided that we wanted to raise some money for the surgeons. And so we came up with an idea of hosting a charity ball. Some friends of ours had done a similar thing and they'd raised a few quid, and we thought, yeah, it'd be a nice thing to do and a great way to thank not just the surgeons, but so many others, you know. And it's such an important cause. So many people get it, and we just want to make sure that people get the same amazing treatment that Mandy did. It's a funny thing. I don't normally talk about this, and when I do, I always get a little bit choked up. So this for me is kind of like quite a cathartic thing. I just have to put that in. So we decided to host this ball, and the first thing that hit us was the amount of positive energy coming from everybody who wanted, that everyone wanted to be involved in it. So whoever we called up, they all say, yeah, what do you need? We're there for you. The first person we called, obviously, was Kimmy. And I said, look, Kim, we've got this idea. would you be up for performing and, you know, doing a couple of numbers on the night? And she said, yeah, of course, absolutely. No questions asked. And that kind of set the ball rolling. And it was through that that we could ask other people, and they wanted to get involved too. So it kind of snowballed after that. And that was one of the most beautiful things, and the most rewarding things. And through that, we've met some incredible people, Jake being just one of them. That all started, Mandy literally just put a letter through his front door. We'd heard that he'd moved in locally. So Mandy and I wrote this little letter saying, if there's any EastEnders stuff you could whack over for the auction section, that would be wonderful. Not expecting any answer or any more than that, because we have done that to a few celebs around here and we haven't heard anything back. But Jake's lovely wife, Alison, was immediately on the phone to Mandy and said, look, we really do care about this and we really want to get involved in it. And of course, now they're a major part of it, and it's lovely. Me and Jakey, we did the auction together. Jakey always comes up with so many different prizes, and like Kim, he's just been an incredible support, and so has Alison. The two of them together have been such a great support, and we, you know, we're so very grateful to them for that. And also, you know, through Jake, this whole podcast came about. So it's amazing all the positive stuff that's actually come out from this seemingly negative thing, you know. But I digress on that one. Back to the ball. So basically, it's a bi-yearly event. It's held at Nidworth House. We normally have about 500, 550 people coming. And they all turn up. We have a lovely slap-up meal. And then we get to the business end of it, where we have the auction. And then we get into the live music section. This year we had Clive from Doctor and the Medics. He was actually comparing the whole show for us as well. Obviously, Bluey, some were there, Neville, smashing it out. And he was amazing. We had Carol Decker. Carol's done it two or three times now. And actually, three or four times. We had Bucks Fizz. We had Nick Kershaw, who's done every one of them so far with this. Martin from ABC, bless him, he came down as well. He's done two or three of the shows. Kimmy's done every show as well. Obviously, Kim was going to do it. But historically, we've had Tony Hadley, Rick Astley, Go West, Haircut 100. And everyone who I've asked, they've all said yes, and they've all come, and they've been amazing. We can't thank those guys enough. So the money that was raised for the ball, well, for the last two, actually, it's been slightly different. The first two, because we've done four now, the first two were for the surgeons that saved Mandy's life. And then we decided we wanted to go a little bit bigger, and we decided that we wanted to raise money and raise awareness for a new radiotherapy unit in Hertfordshire, of which there are none, shamefully. There's quite a few in London, but not one in Hertfordshire. So if you're unlucky enough to get cancer, if you're going to have radiotherapy, you're going to have to travel an hour a day to Mount Vernon or Addenbrookes or, you know, miles away. And bearing in mind, you have to rely on a lift for this, because you're going to come out of there feeling wiped out. And some of these treatments can go on for months. So it's pretty unacceptable that there is no radiotherapy unit in Hertfordshire. I just think it's just unbelievable, unforgivable and shameful that it's not been sorted yet. But we're working on it. We're in close contact with the local MPs to try and make this happen. I think the best thing that anyone can do listening here on this podcast is if they can get in contact with their local MP and basically lobby for this unit, because it's so needed. It's going to be extortionately expensive to build this unit, but, you know, it can be done. I think the more people get involved and the more people that care about it, like we do, the more chance we have of making it happen. So all the money that we're raising now is going towards that for when it's built. So, yeah, so far the money raised has been around 390,000 in all, in total. The last ball alone was 140, just over 140,000. A lot of it down to some incredible people that we've become very good friends with, who I won't mention who they are because they're very private people. But yeah, they've been a massive, massive part of the whole ball as well, the whole setup. And they are probably the most remarkable people Mandy and I have ever met. And we feel blessed to know them and count them as dear friends. So yeah, that's pretty much it really. I just wanted to talk about that and let people know what it's about. And if you guys want to get involved, please tweet me. And you know, I'm all ears. Any ideas, I'm on at Wild Ricky, WildRicky on Twitter. So please just get in contact with me and let me know if you have any ideas to raise any money or awareness for that particular thing. And it would be much appreciated. Finally, another thing I wanted to say was that when the morning we got that phone call, in our minds, it was kind of like the beginning of the end. It was like the darkest moment of our lives, looking at each other, absolutely terrified. Absolutely terrified. And it was... We couldn't have ever believed that actually was the beginning of the most amazing chapter of our lives, and probably the most important, and also the best. And we've met some incredible people, and who would have believed that something such a horrendous experience could turn into something so bloody wonderful. So, yeah, so I think that's about it. Don't think there's anything more I need to talk about. So I'll just move on. Thank you for listening. I really do appreciate that. Next week, we're going to get back to the normal episode of Unsung Heroes, and we'll be chatting with some more legends. So, yeah, have a great week, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye. You have been listening to Unsung Heroes with me, Ricky Wild, Jake Wood and Lee Bennett. Produced and created by myself and Jake Wood for Wildwood Productions. With music and editing, again by myself, Ricky Wild. Artwork by Scarlett Wild and hosted by Acast. Just to remind you that there is a link in the notes directing you to a Spotify playlist featuring all the songs we have discussed in this episode. Many thanks for listening. Unsung Heroes.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.